Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love people who love dogs and cats, which is what this show is all about. Thanks for listening on Long Island's only NPR station, WLIW-FM, where Dog Talk originated 13 years ago. You can hear all previous 680 shows in the podcast library at RadioPetLady.com, along with my other Pet Talk podcast radio programs. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes a wide variety of high-protein recipes for cats and dogs using human-grade ingredients. Because the Foreman family respects the nutritional needs of cats as obligate carnivores, they make only wet food in cans and pouches, so cats can avoid dry, carbohydrate-based food. This show is also made possible by Dr. Elsie's, a privately owned company founded and run by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado. Dr. Elsie has personally created specialized litters to meet every cat's needs along with their human family members. Dr. Elsie's is also the founding sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival. This show is also supported by Earth Animal, privately owned by Dr. Bob and Susan Goldstein, who've combined science and nature to create products for natural animal wellness. Earth Animal's Nature's Protection line provides flea and tick solutions without chemicals, and their Zen Tabs and Zen Pens are made with full-spectrum hemp oil with naturally occurring CBD to calm cats and dogs with anxiety. I have wonderful guests today. Ruth Ann Lobos will be here. She's a wonderful vet who does many specialized things. She works for Merrick, but we are going to talk about summer safety issues, mostly with dogs because kitties live indoors, so summer doesn't affect them so much. Dr. Elsie is going to be here. Precious Cat is underwriting a series of free webinars for kitten caregivers with the National Kitten Coalition. And he's going to tell us about what those are about and why they're valuable to those who look after the littlest kitties. And Dr. Philip Bergman will be here talking about the VCA Pet Cancer Care Centers, which have opened recently. For those of you who are old-fashioned and listen to the show live on Saturday mornings and have done for these long 13 years, you're going to have to reset your clocks because starting next week, Dog Talk and Kitties 2 is going to be Sunday mornings at 7, so I hope you're early risers. When WNET bought our station, which we're so proud and happy about, they've switched around the schedule and gotten a lot of great national shows to join our NPR lineup. So tune in Sundays at 7 a.m. instead of Saturdays, but if you're a podcast listener, nothing changes. Dr. Ruth Ann Lobos, thank you so much for being here. I love all the things that you're interested in, pet health, canine rehabilitation. You're a serious athlete living in Boulder, Colorado yourself. And I love your passion about many things about pet health. And I met you through Merrick, which is one of the great sponsors of this show, at Global Pet Expo back in the days when people gathered together. And I thought you were great. And I thought, what could we talk about on the air? And you suggested summer safety. I never do topical, timely things like that. Bad on me. So I would love you to talk about some of the things you want to caution people about during the summer to keep pets safe.
Yeah. Well, it was great meeting you. It seems like eons ago in a different whole universe.
Yes.
When we met in Orlando. Thank you for having me on your show. And thanks to your listeners for, as you said, if they're getting up early on Sunday morning, maybe they're getting ready for their Sunday morning routine and have us on the radio or have downloaded us through the podcast. But yeah, I'm so glad that there are people who are passionate about pets and all things encompassing like you are that can share our message and certainly the pet parents at home who are listening and love their four-legged as much as they love their two-legged family members.
Yes.
So with the temperatures starting to rise outside and you know, with all of us having been, I think, stuck indoors a lot with the pandemic, we're starting to kind of venture out a little bit more. And our pets get to embrace some of that outdoor warm weather as well. And I know, you know, we've joked, I've seen this meme come across on different social media channels about, you know, after being stuck indoors because of the pandemic, we now understand about why our dogs get so excited about going on car rides.
Yes, that's a good point.
You know, which I'm like, there's been days, multiple in a row, where, you know, my car hasn't left our garage.
Yes.
So certainly something to really keep in mind, because I think, it can often be overlooked, is if we are taking our pets with us, you know, maybe for the companionship, for their mental stimulation, or if we're going to go on a road trip, and we're taking them in the car, there's a number of things to consider with that. Certainly, if you are going to leave your pet in the car when you're going to go run inside, whether it's to pick up some groceries or something like that, keeping in mind how warm it is outside. And, you know, even at 80 degrees, which for most of us feels lovely and would be a fantastic, you know, temperature to be out in the backyard, inside our car with the windows rolled up, it can get over 100 degrees in just a matter of minutes.
Let me interrupt for a minute, Ruth Ann, and say that I've done so many shows on heat danger in cars. And the thing that people even today don't understand is, with the windows rolled up, people say, oh, but I leave the window open a little. With all the windows down, all four of them all the way down, which would be dangerous. The dog could jump out, or someone, if they thought your dog was darling, could take it. It still is unbearable. The heat, it's an oven. So basically, I mean, I have this rule for myself, and even the other day I felt so guilty. I have like 68 as the temperature, and parking in the so-called shade. Shade changes all the time. The sun, the earth move. So shade is not a static thing. It was too hot. They were panting. Yeah. I'm sorry, girls. I'm sorry, I said. And it was 68. And I live in Vermont. You're in Colorado. We don't even have high humidity. So basically, nobody just goes into a store for 5 minutes. There's no such thing. Everybody heard the story that I busted some lady that went into Starbucks years ago on the main street of East Hampton. And I called the police and I stood by her car. And it wasn't 90 degrees. And she wasn't in there for 5 minutes, because bless them, at Starbucks, nothing takes 5 minutes at Starbucks. It's the slowest line in America. And God knows now with social distancing how they handle it. So should we just say that if you take your dog in the car, take your dog out of the car with you, leaving aside how hot the sidewalk is, a whole nother issue? Can we just say that? Because otherwise people go, it was only a minute. Oh, I parked in the shade. Oh, my dog has my dogs are Weimaraners. They don't have any fur. So what? They don't have any way to sweat either, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that's, you know, that's a really, really good point that a lot of people kind of forget about, is, you know, that their ability to, you know, to offload heat, they don't sweat like we do, right? So they pant and their heat gets released through their tongue, and, you know, a lot of times, like, their if you'll notice, their when they get really hot, that their ears turn bright red.
Yes.
They sweat just a tiny amount through their paws. For those of us that have cats at home, and if we take them to the vet clinic, sometimes we put them up on the table and they leave their little, they leave their little sweaty cat poppers.
Yes, you're right.
Stainless steel table. But for the, for the most part, that heat exchange for them really just takes place mostly through panting. And then if you add layer on top of that, I have a French bulldog, and so the smoothie based breeds, it's even more challenging for them. So, I think it's, while it may be really nice to have them, be able to run errands with us, if we're going to, go run to the store or something like that.
Do it at night.
Really,
do it at night in the dark.
Exactly.
And there are people also that leave the car running, some newfangled cars, you can leave it running with the air conditioning running. That's helpful, but it isn't the solution, because when the sun hits that car, it's still an oven that has an air conditioner on inside it. So
yeah.
I mean, how about barbecuing? Barbecuing something where someone brought up something years ago that I've put out of my mind. If you did something on a stick, like, you know, a kebabi kind of thing, that the dogs can get. I mean, that's really bad. And you're a vet, and you, besides being the official vet of Merrick, you also do fill in for vet clinics. That can be kind of awful. Are there other things, strings and sticks around barbecuing that people discard and dogs get at them and then they swallow them and then they're in surgery?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that we sometimes forget about. I mean, there's the obvious, you know, oh, don't let your dog steal the steak off of
right,
the barbecue.
Right.
Or, you know, keep the, if you're having, you know, even in this day and age, if you're having a social gathering, make sure you keep a lid on the garbage can so they
right,
don't get into the chicken bones and all of those things. But oftentimes we forget about the barbecue tools themselves.
Yes.
And I can tell you, from, you know, thankfully it wasn't my own dog, but it was actually a good friend of mine, their dog, they had, you know, cleaned off the grill with one of those wire bristle
yep,
barbecue brushes.
Right.
And, you know, gone that day, you know, finished the barbecue, all that sort of stuff. But that next morning, let the dog out, and came out with into the backyard wondering what was taking, you know, Gunter so long
right,
to come back in. And it turned out he had eaten all of the wire bristles off of the brush. And, you know, we wound up having to do an exploratory surgery and take out part of his intestines and,
wow,
because they had clumped together into this like porcupine ball with intestines. So, you know, so those that to me has, I mean, you know, has stuck in my brain. No,
that's
pun
a good one. Yeah, but that's a good one.
Yeah.
Even if you wiped off the grill with, and Labradors, I'm so sick of hearing stories of Labradors eating people's brassieres. I've never understood any part of that anecdote. But as a doctor, you probably have, they claim, taken entire pairs of underpants and brassieres out of Labradors' guts. But certainly if you wipe down the grill, or even maybe napkins covered in delicious barbecue-type grease. By the way, Merrick, this is not really a plug for Merrick because that would be tacky, but they have these delicious barbecue flavors of their, like, I think of them as summer dog foods, and they're the cutest pictures of these dogs smiling, and really an unnatural smile, but their lips and face are covered in barbecue sauce. It's so cute. But if but if you were to wipe your hands or your face or your kids' faces or the grill with paper towel or cloth, the dog, there are many dogs who will eat that. I mean, it tastes good. They don't recognize that it's indigestible paper or cloth, right? Or tin foil. If there's tin foil, which in these days, of course, isn't really made of tin. That was my mother's phrase. And it's covered in delicious drippings and stuff. Dogs will absolutely eat it. For sure.
Yep. And then, you know, I mean, some of the other things that we think about now that it's summertime and we want, you know, I mean, I give my dogs treats. You know, I think the important thing, my little nutrition plug here, and one of my big platforms is,
right,
you know, keeping our dogs nice and lean.
Absolutely.
But they still, you know, they still can have some treats and have fun. And, you know, especially this time of year with, like, you know, our raspberries and blueberries and, you know, and those sorts of things that are starting to really come into season. Those are great treats, you know, that you can
right,
give for your pets as well. You know, and especially when we think about, okay, if it's hot outside, you know, we can make little popsicles and, you know, and offer those sorts of treats. So certainly some, you know, some of the human foods are, you know, are safe for our pets, but we certainly want to, you know, avoid other things that are oftentimes part of barbecue. So things like onions and garlic and those sorts of things that can, you know, be part of either, you know, a side for your dish or something like that. So avoiding those. And one of the ones that I didn't really realize, but rhubarb is toxic to our dog.
How many people want to eat rhubarb? No offense to the rhubarb growers of the world, but this is not the most delicious thing, and you have to drench it in sugar for it to be palatable.
Well, I would agree, but I just had a rhubarb jam filled homemade donut.
That sounds heaven.
It was amazing.
Oh yeah, okay, rhubarb jam. Yeah, at this point we get into a lot of sugar. That's so funny. I just think of a bowl of rhubarb as being this thing that looks a little bit like a jellyfish, but you know, there's aficionados of everything. I think the idea of the fruits is great, or even the fruits frozen. They sell frozen fruits, so you could give them one raspberry, one blackberry. I also feed frozen broccoli. I call it a green popsicle, and my dogs adore frozen broccoli for us. They won't eat it cooked, and they won't eat it raw, but they eat it frozen. So it's another refreshing sort of treat. Do you recommend using one of the bone broths that's on the market for dogs and cats to make the popsicles?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's a really great suggestion, and something that again helps with hydration, because even though we talked about just a minute ago, they don't sweat a whole lot, but they still need water helps to keep them cool. Sometimes dogs get so excited that they just forget to drink water,
Or if they're panting really heavily. That's another thing that I discovered, because I go on hikes every day with my dogs. Not like you, she's a triathlete and a marathoner, good God. But I mean, they're very gentle hikes. Not so much gentle for the dogs. They go full tilt. But if they're panting really hard, you can't pant really hard and drink at the same time. You have to kind of prehydrate, right?
Yeah. So having some, oftentimes our dogs love novel things anyway. So if it smells different and then it tastes different, and in this case with a lot of the bone broths and stuff, it's going to have a little bit of salt and meatiness flavor to it that, most of the guys just love it. And you can even put it in for your cats as well. Some cats love to kind of bat things around in the water dish. And
they do.
And they love that. Certainly they're carnivores by nature. So having that extra meatiness, it can certainly be another thing that, that is attractive for them to keep their hydration up.
That's a great idea, because cats don't drink much by their nature. They're not really quote unquote supposed to, but they feel the heat. Not everybody has central air or wants to have it on all the time. And especially a long haired cat, indoors only doesn't matter. There's humidity. And, they're not all that, to see a cat pant is a sad sight in my view. I feel so sorry for that little panting cat, because their tongue isn't really made for it as well, is it?
Exactly. No, it's not. I don't know why, but I feel like maybe the cats that I've had in my life are part like lizard or something, but they love to lay in the sun. So they are just little magnets for the sun. And so then, like you said, that just increases their body temperature. And so having some little ice cubes made of bone broth in their water dish can help keep them cool as well.
It's important to send a shout out to the kitties too, because the dogs get so much more attention during summer. And to cats, it's like, no big deal. Where the sun goes is different. And they get different birds to look at outside the window, and squirrels and stuff like that. So it's helpful. We've run out of time, Ruth Ann, but it's been great to talk to you, and really wonderful for people to just be mindful of all the things around you that can affect your pets negatively. And of course, do all the things around you can think of that affect them positively. Thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. This show is brought to you in part by Merrick Pet Food, which has been making natural, nutritious pet food for 30 years, with varieties crafted with healthy grains or their grain-free recipes. Merrick Foods never use preservatives, fillers, or anything artificial. Recipes always start with proteins, USDA certified meats and fresh caught fish as the first ingredient, along with actual fresh fruits and vegetables. This show is brought to you in part by Zymox Orotine Dental Products, whose oral gels and sprays help keep dogs' teeth clean. Zymox also makes dermatology products for dogs and cats, topical cream and spray for skin conditions, which work to prevent or reduce inflammation and heal skin irritations. And for dogs with chronic ear problems, Zymox has an ear cleaning solution. This show is also sponsored by Canine Active, a natural mobility supplement to help senior dogs with the aches and pains of old age move comfortably again. Clinical trials of Canine Active show improvement in a dog's mobility within a week without side effects, and it can be safely used along with other supplements and medications. I am delighted to welcome back to the show Dr. Bruce Elsie. He is the Dr. Elsie of Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat, which is not only one of the longest time sponsors of this show and my show Cat Chat, and the founding and continuing sponsor of the Cat Film Festival, which is on a pause button right now. But watch out, folks. We are coming back strong when the theaters open again, and also with some streaming versions. But what I want to let everyone know about, not just kitten caregivers who are out there, these frontline workers on behalf of little litters of kittens whose life hangs in the balance. The National Kitten Coalition has webinars online Tuesday, June 9th, already gone by, Tuesday, June 23rd, and Wednesday, July 8th, all of which we'll make sure to let you know more about on social media. But what's really extraordinary is that these webinars are completely free to the public, thanks to Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat. He has underwritten this. And when I say he, the company is him and his wife. They own this company together. They do endless good deeds. And I just really feel it's important for someone so modest and humble to be celebrated greatly for the work that you do, Dr. Elsie. You're always doing it under the radar for all the right reasons. And for people interested in the demands of that are on the people taking care of vulnerable little kitten litters, it'll be great to listen to the webinars. But I just really want to give you 1,000 pats on the back for that. You're on the front lines with the kitten helpers.
Well, thank you, Tracy, for all you do to, to put forth really the plight, if you will, of all these little kittens going into shelters. And
yes,
then, of course, the foster care that's is necessary, because you need to get those kittens into an environment where they have less stresses and where these endemic diseases, feline panleukopenia virus, herpes virus, colitis virus, where these kittens have a chance, because obviously these viruses are a huge issue in many shelter situations. And so if we can get these kittens into foster care environments, then that obviously is going to really help break that cycle.
And these webinars that the National Kitten Coalition is putting on with your backing, Panleukopenia in Perspective is a workshop webinar. So if anybody loves cats a lot, well, most of the people listening do love them a lot, and you're just curious, well, what are these endless, terrible viruses and diseases that kittens and grown cats are susceptible to, and what can be done to help them? It's just great education. I'm going to listen because there aren't many ways to find out this information. But is it true that, I'll say back in the day, but the day could have been today, depending on the shelter and whether they have fosters nearby and rescues, that when litters of kittens came into a shelter, did they presume that they would just die? Did they put them to sleep? Because, I mean, there's so much money, time, effort that has to go into just keeping them alive. Are these fosters and the National Kitten Coalition saving lives in this kind of a fundamental way? If they couldn't go to these caregivers, they would die?
I think that the short answer would be that that these small kittens in a shelter environment are a huge problem for the entire shelter population.
Yes.
And so not only are they a fomite, if you will, almost, for continuing disease in those shelters, but also their chances of survival are pretty low because of just the stress involvement that there are, and then the chances that even if they don't have these viruses, that they will pick them up. So the foster aspect is a real game changer for kitten mortality.
Yes.
And it's just huge that people are willing to step up and care for these neonatal kittens.
It's extraordinary. And the amount of work, hour after hour, Hannah Shaw is known as the kitten lady and is very renowned within the field for being someone who does this herself and goes out and teaches courses and classes and is the cheerleader of all the people doing this. But every hour they need various kinds of care around the clock for weeks. These brave souls, the little kittens and the people taking care of them, are really also like TNR people, kind of working in the shadows. Most people aren't aware of it. Someone recently wrote in who'd adopted a kitten somehow or other. I don't know if it was directly from a shelter. And she wrote in privately to me on Facebook why someone wouldn't do it publicly so everyone could learn. Well, you know, they're saying this kitten needs vaccinations. I don't really believe in vaccinations. I'm like, oh my God. Can we talk a little bit about vaccinations and the essential use of them in kittens and cats who are so susceptible to disease? I mean, if we only get that message across, you have to vaccinate. Is that not true? And is there any case in which you say, don't vaccinate?
Well, in answer to your latter question, we did used to say not to use a modified live panleukopenia vaccine in pregnant queens because that can cause some neurological deficit in their kittens. But even now, that's been called into question. And the neurological deficit being that if later in their pregnancy they got a modified live vaccine for panleukopenia, what we used to call distemper.
That's interesting. So that's another word for distemper.
Yes. Yeah.
I'll be darned.
So that's another word for distemper, which has really been poor nomenclature forever. But that's, I mean, in most of the literature, they don't even say that. But I go back a long way. So, you know, I actually was seeing, when I first started practicing back in 77.
Right.
We would see these, these kittens that had what's referred to as cerebellar hypoplasia. And the cerebellum, which is at the back of your brain, it controls really fine motor movement. So they would have exaggerated, really strange walk that they would have. So So this vaccine, and, you know, that would be about the only thing that I could think of that historically was a recommendation for not vaccinating. We recommend for just cats in households that if your cat actually is sick, to hold off on vaccines.
Of course.
But in a shelter environment, that is definitely not the recommendation. These kittens need to be vaccinated as soon as possible. Even before they get into a situation where they're in a shelter or foster, they need to be vaccinated every 2 weeks.
Yes.
And they need to be vaccinated until they are over 20 weeks of age, which is a different recommendation than for household cats. We usually say vaccinate every 4 weeks and not really wait on vaccines until they are 8 weeks. Now, these kittens in shelters, it's recommended to start vaccinating at 4 weeks because it is recommended to use the modified live viruses because you get an immediate immune response with a modified live virus, whereas the inactivated or killed virus vaccines, it takes at least a week, 2 weeks to develop any kind of durable immunity.
Interesting.
And so if you get that kind of vaccine and anticipate that it's going to really help you in a shelter environment or a an environment where there's a lot of kittens going through, that's not really realistic. You need to use modified live viral vaccines. You need to use them at 4 weeks. And something I ran across a while back that I thought was really interesting about vaccines is that in the Southeast, and they didn't really give the specific shelter, they said that 300 cats were brought into the shelter, and they did antibody testing on all of these cats, and they found the panleukopenia, or the or what I would refer to as distemper.
Right.
They found that 60% of those cats did not have protective levels
Wow.
of antibodies against panleukopenia. For feline herpes virus, 89% did not have protective levels. And for Calissa virus, 63% did not have protective levels. So, you know, that speaks to the fact that there's a huge population out there. You know, we're talking about herd protection,
right,
if you will,
right,
for the whole COVID-19
correct,
thing.
Correct, correct.
Well, you know, there's a huge population out there of cats, based on the 300 cats that were going into this shelter, that would benefit from vaccine.
I'll say. Because, as you say, in a herd, in a group, whether it's people at a protest, or in a school, or in a nursing home, or cats in a shelter, or even in a very busy foster home, all this stuff gets shared. And if you don't have any immunity against it, because you have not, your body hasn't developed the antibodies, then you're going to get it. I mean, it's really extraordinary how sort of rumors, ignorance, ideas that vaccines are a bad thing has happened in America. Maybe it's happened in other countries. I'm not that aware of it. America, where we don't see diseases because they've been eradicated in humans by vaccinating religiously. In yours and my generation, we had smallpox vaccine. We were given polio vaccine. And these diseases,
right,
which devastate still in the developing worlds, are gone from America. They can all come back, right, Dr. Elsie? I mean, just like in...
Well, absolutely.
I mean, come back in,
yes,
in worse versions. I mean, we need to vaccinate ourselves and our animals. The diseases are worse than what? Having, you know, 1 in a million supposedly cats got some sort of bad reaction, even including cancer at the site of a vaccination. Perhaps that's the case, but it's infinitesimal compared to how many cats were protected from, I believe that was rabies, but other things. I think it's really great that you brought up COVID-19 and the fact that none of us is safe until there's a vaccine. And they say 7 out of 10 Americans say they'll get it, but the anti-vax movement is full of brim and firestone. So I don't know. It's concerning, is it not, to a doctor who sees in animals the value of vaccinating?
Well, I had a English teacher in college who actually had polio, and, you know, so she had difficulty walking. She had braces on her legs.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is not, I mean, you know, I was born, you know, when the earth was still cooling, but still.
And it was still warm when I was born. I mean, you know, hadn't fully cooled, but I have a friend. She lives in Palm Springs today. She's 70s, and she has polio. One of her legs is shorter than the other. Her family moved from the East Coast to, I believe at that time, they thought dry air would be good, to Arizona or somewhere. A family friend's son, not a teacher, but my own generation growing up. So if I'm a baby boomer, there's tons of people that have never seen, you know, measles. We some of us had chicken pox, but I mean, so many, and now they're getting shingles. And now there's vaccines for all of it. So it's really to be taken very seriously for your animals. Don't think that. I remember hearing about a Rhodesian Ridgeback breeder, a very smart woman that wrote a lot, I think, for the Whole Dog Journal or something, who had some belief that if if the litter or that she went to dog shows that other dogs having been vaccinated would be safe. And many litters were lost. Many litters of puppies dropped dead because they didn't get the distemper and the parvo vaccines. And kittens are so vulnerable to so many diseases. I think it's really an important message to everybody. Don't close your mind and your ears if you hear the word vaccine and think bad. Hear the word vaccine and thank the scientists working on it. Thank the companies who were all these years going way back to Dr. Bruce's and my childhoods and before, who developed vaccines that saved us from horrendous diseases. And these National Kitten Coalition webinars are there to educate people about panleukopenia and about upper respiratory infections and diarrhea in kittens, which is the next webinar, which we don't have time to talk about. But all these things are manageable, but you have to know what the signs and symptoms are and be prepared. And the kitten savers are, but it's, I think it's great for all of us to learn about the really great work being done behind the scenes, whether it's by vets or researchers. And certainly the shelters and rescues do an incredible job. And they have this out network of fosters who save all the kittens. So, Dr. Elsie, thanks for having devoted your life to cats. You've done so much for them and continue to do it in making sure the next generation of kittens and their caregivers is as informed and empowered as possible. I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Tracy. And thank you, really, for all the things that you do through your through your radio show and your books and everything. I mean, it's just an invaluable thing to all of the pet owners, cats and dogs out there that you're willing to dedicate so much of your life and experience to furthering animal welfare and just, the human-animal bond, which, I think that just... it's a great thing. So,
well, you're very kind to say it. I truly consider it a privilege to sit in this chair behind this microphone or at the computer writing. I really genuinely believe that I'm a conduit for all the big thinkers, for all the big doers, a conduit so everybody can share in what they're doing. And you're certainly among them, as is your wife. So carry on as you are, and we old dinosaurs will keep on bringing the message of how things used to be, and we don't want them to be like that anymore. So vaccinate yourselves as soon as you can to anything they have a vaccine for, and your kittens and your grown cats, not to mention your puppies and dogs. Thanks so much, Dr. Elsie, and thanks so much for being here again.
Well, thank you, Tracy.
This show is brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, a privately owned company making fresh dog food shipped to your door. Evermore is owned by two women who select fresh organic vegetables mixed with fresh, humanely raised beef, lamb, chicken, or turkey to make nutritionally balanced dog food. After low-temperature cooking, the sealed pouches are frozen and shipped right to your home to be served as a complete meal or as part of your pet's diet. We are also supported by Iceland Pure, a privately owned company that guarantees freshness and purity in their human-grade omega-3 fish oils for pets, odor-free salmon, sardine, and anchovy fish oils, responsibly sourced in the clean waters of Iceland and Norway. Now they have added next-level premier fish oil with the documented health benefits of shark oil. The show is also supported by Daily Dose, a daily dental chew with an outer layer that cleans dogs' teeth, using a patented ingredient that breaks down the biofilm and harmful bacteria that can accumulate on teeth and gums. The core of each chew contains clinically proven supplements to help manage a dog's joint, heart, skin, or anxieties. I am delighted to invite Dr. Philip Bergman back to the show. He was on the show a number of years ago when he helped develop the canine melanoma vaccine, Oncept, at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where as a veterinary oncologist, he's also an adjunct faculty member, which isn't that amazing when you see that his PhD fellowship was in human cancer biology from MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, a five-year fellowship. So, Dr. Philip, it's wonderful to have you back and to know that you now are the director of clinical studies for VCA, Veterinary Centers of America, and also continue to practice as an oncologist at the Katona Bedford Veterinary Center, where you've been for 13 years, a really long time. Congratulations on continuing to push forward the boundaries of what we can do for dogs and cats who have cancer.
Well, it's very nice to hear your voice again, Tracy. It's kind of funny how things turn around like that.
It is.
So I'm more than happy to talk with you today.
I guess what caught my attention was that VCA, which originally was just a few hospitals, and then they used to sort of buy up and manage hospitals, but not really own them. Now VCA does own its own network of 35 vet special with a lot of specialist vet centers around the country. And you are in charge of a network of cancer treatment centers, right?
Well, my real job, as you pointed out in the introduction, is I run clinical studies for VCA. And then I'm also one of the principal folks associated with the PCCA. So I run one of the research subcommittees for that group. Dr. Zach Wright is actually the chair of the PCCA. So we work very, very closely together.
Pet Cancer Care Center. I remember when a nephrologist actually out in L.A. started the Cancer Care Centers of America when his teenage daughter got bone cancer, and there was no such idea that humans could go to a place that was just a cancer care center. I don't know what's happened to that. It's gone sort of up and down, and now a lot of big hospitals have their own cancer departments. But the idea of a cancer treatment center for pets is somewhat unique, is it not? The idea of it being a network of cancer treatment centers.
You're very right. It is incredibly unique. It's something that I'm really, really proud to be part of. If you look at how this has sort of grown in the human space, there is the iteration that you spoke of, but really the penultimate setting where that has happened on the human side is where the National Cancer Institute places a hospital through a very, very rigorous investigation to become a comprehensive cancer center designation.
I see.
And yeah, for folks that are going through cancer care themselves, I highly encourage them to arm themselves with information about these centers, because these are, again, the penultimate cancer, both diagnosis as well as treatment sites across the country. And so our thought was, is that can we take a step towards that side of things? And our real goals were a couple things. Most veterinary oncologists that are in private practice, we're relatively siloed.
Yes,
meaning that
yes.
There's just not a lot of cross communication, and we felt that there was a unique ability just based on the size of the and uniqueness of the breadth of the network of VCA, both in Canada as well as in the U.S., and could we actually provide some tools that got those oncologists out of their silos and began not just working with the folks that they were working with locally, but then start to work on a national and an international level. So it was a pretty remarkable vision, within VCA to be able to do that. And, we started in August of last year, and we've been extremely busy and have had multiple meetings face-to-face, and we're just now starting to see the fruits of those labors.
It's very interesting how you personally, in your professional career, have been a bridge between human and animal study of oncology, looking for treatments, looking for vaccines, looking for extended quality of life and length of life. And it really is multidisciplinary, not only within the vet world, but between human and animal. And I guess that's one of the things that people don't understand, is that it seems to me that cancer research and cancer treatment and care does take many minds and many brains and a lot of personal experience. I'm sure that the docs fresh out of vet school and fresh out of human med school are brilliant and great, but it seems to me that the graybeards who've been at it for a long time like you are the ones who see the big picture. You know what hasn't worked, and you can see down the road what might, some of the ideas that might work. And I think that it's constantly pushing that boundary that must make this a not depressing specialty for you to practice in. I'm sure people say, oh my God, you're a cancer doctor, how depressing. But that's not your experience, I don't think.
It really isn't. If you, we, we have our days. I won't sugarcoat it that way. There are days where when we lose our patience, you know, that sticks with you. It stays in your core. But at the same exact time, when you look at other scenarios that we've had remarkable advances within surgical veterinary oncology, within radiation veterinary oncology, within medical veterinary oncology, and, you know, where my heart is with immunotherapeutics, and those have had a remarkable explosion on the human side and have really translated into major advances to the point where finally, for the first time, cancer death rates are actually going down, whereas for the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years that they've been collating those statistics, they've continued to rise. And we very much see the same things happening on the veterinary side. And so it really, as you pointed out, it's no different whether you're a dog, cat, or a person. It's that multidisciplinary approach to cancer, both diagnosis as well as treatment, that is so integral. And that's the other part of this PCCA, where we're bringing those various oncologists together to get them to be talking further, doing research together. And that way, when clients make the decision to come to one of us for a consultation, it's a scenario where we can then take the fruits of those labors that we talked about previously, and it allows that oncologist to give the very, very best recommendations to that client, and then they can take that information and then make the right decision for them and their loved one.
One of the problems that I see, and I see it with my neighbor, let a cat die of a brain tumor without treating it, has an aging Labrador with some kind of sarcoma. He isn't even clear the name of it, but he's not going to treat it. This is a person with unlimited money and devoted to his animal. People still don't understand that treating cancer in dogs, cats get less cancer, but also treating it in cats, doesn't look at all like treating humans with cancer. So, that's one of the problems. People think, oh my God, I would never want to put my dog through that chemo or through that radiation or all that horrible surgery and bring them to the brink of death, which is often done in human oncology as the only way to deal with many kinds of cancer. And that isn't what you do in veterinary oncology. Do you find that people, how would you know, really? It's a silly question on my part. You can't find that people don't want to treat because then they wouldn't come to an oncologist. You're only seeing the ones who want that extra year or two, which translates to, you know, a third or a quarter of a dog's life. How do we get people to understand that it's a very gentle, mild treatment in dogs?
Yeah, it's only with, you know, dissemination of information through avenues like yours, in addition to continuing to, you know, beat your fist on the table and talk more and more about this, that information gets out there. And you're very right. A lot of the things that we do, when you look at our goals often in veterinary oncology, it's probably as much, if not more, about quality of life, not necessarily length of life.
Right.
And, you know, when you and I go to our oncologists, you know, our goals are, you know, you want to live for your kids and your grandkids, and, you know, Godspeed ahead. I'm willing to put up with whatever side effects there are. And I think we have the unique ability to look into the future to put up with those side effects. Whereas I'm fond of telling my clients that, you know, I don't know that our dogs look into the future that way. I think that they live for the day to make us happy. I know of very few beings like them. And so do we want to ruin that quality of life for what period of time that they have with us? So you're very right. Dogs and cats handle chemotherapy remarkably better than humans do. Part of that is our dose intensity is less because of those quality of life aspirations that mm-hmm. we just talked about. I also think that they're just inherently tougher than us. You know, they don't deal with the psychological implications of what cancer is about. They just continue going on living their lives, again, trying to make us happy. You know, that said, when we have folks come in to do a consultation with us, our job is to assimilate all that information, what are the goals for the owner, and we often will then talk about, okay, this is the standard of care option, and that will cause, you know, this implication related to quality of life, which the vast majority of the time is incredibly acceptable. But then we often are very good about offering Plan B and Plan C. And when I talk with clients, it's often a mix of emotion, logistics, and finances.
Yes.
I feel our job is to give all those options and then have them make the decision. And we obviously will support whatever that decision is, because we don't know about that owner's fears and financial abilities and all those aspects. So our goal is really to empower them with information.
The thing I would say, which I say every time I get a chance, is no matter what age dog or cat you've got, more importantly dogs, since they get so much more cancer than cats, and whether it's 25% of dogs or 50% of dogs, it doesn't matter to you. When your dog is diagnosed, it's 100% for your dog. Please get pet insurance. Now, Trupanion has a way that they now pay the vet directly. So no money comes out of your pocket other than your deductible. And that for a lot of people is great. I have Healthy Paws. And once you commit to a company, you stay with them because nothing is disallowed if you, from the time you get the insurance. But it means that when you go to consider, am I going to look for a VCA hospital that has this multidisciplinary oncology department and I can listen to the smartest minds in the field and then make a decision, it's really nice to not say, so that choice A would be $11,000 and choice B would be $800. You aren't going to make a decision financially. So I just urge everybody, you know, take the time, go online, look at your choices. There's a lot of good pet insurance companies. They allow oncologists to do what they do. Without that, most people find it unaffordable or make pretty bad financial decisions and wind up with their hands tied for too long, in my view, for the reward. Can you explain what immunotherapeutics is? You mentioned it.
Yes, I'd love to go back to the insurance side, because I could not agree more strongly with you, because I don't know that we as a profession have done a really good job of educating clients that invariably, as those pets age, there's going to be some event, whether that is a, you know, a horrific hit by car or a cancer diagnosis or whatever that scenario is. And many times that is a, you know, it's a multi-$1,000 type of experience that is just out of the blue. And for many families, that is a potential wreck on their finances. And insurance actually represents a mechanism for those pets to actually get treated.
Yes.
I think it, you know, I also look at it from the standpoint that, you know, if you're a family that $5,000 or $6,000 out of the blue type of thing has occurred, and you can afford that, then you probably don't need insurance. But if a $5,000 or $6,000 out of the blue scenario happens, and you can't afford it, then insurance is incredibly very much your friend. So I could not more strongly positively agree with that.
Thank you for all you're doing on all of our behalves and on behalf of our pets. And anyone lucky enough to be near the Katona Bedford Veterinary Center, where Dr. Bergman practices in person, you're lucky he's there. You're unlucky if your pet got cancer. However, you're probably at some point going to be in the majority, because it strikes fairly heavily and randomly and in your larger breed dogs. So keep an eye on any symptoms. And if your own vet suspects something, try and get to an oncologist if you can. And if you have a VCA near you, that makes it that much the better, because they are really set up to take care of you. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Bergman.
You're very welcome, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's guests. If you missed any shows recently or in any of the prior years, just go to RadioPetLady.com and you can find every show with a description. Kiss your kitties, hug your pooches, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Bye for now.